Please help me welcome to our stage, Susan.
My name's Susan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really nervous. I was sitting up here hyperventilating, and the longer he talked, the more I'm thinking, oh, sure, yeah. Surely you look lovely. We are not at one walk. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. Did I say I'm Susan and I'm an alcoholic? My sobriety date is May 22nd, 1990. And I tell you, that's really a miracle to me. I can't hardly believe it at times. It's like, you know, I mean, I've been here long enough to get old. Which is really, that's a downside of staying sober. But the upside is I'm living still. So, you know, I don't know. Oh, gosh. When I got here, I was 40 years old, and I didn't know how to live drinking. And I didn't know how to live without drinking. And I thought, at 40 years old, I was supposed to know how to live life. You know, I'd been married 3 times and divorced twice and lied about the second one, so I pretended like I'd only been married twice and divorced twice. I happened to be the type of person that I could lie to myself long enough that I started believing. And, you know, at 23 years old, I didn't want to be married twice and divorced twice. So I just started saying I'd never been married the second time. And then I got married the third time. And it wasn't until I was 8 years sober that I got divorced from that second guy. But, which was about 4 days before I got married in sobriety. Oh, my gosh. I remember one time speaking because I'd forgotten. I mean, I lied to myself long enough that it's like that second one hadn't happened. And I was talking at a meeting in Madeira, and I looked at Cheryl after I said something about it. I said, I probably ought to get here then, huh? So finally I did. But I was told before you chair a meeting or speak or something like that, you go into a bathroom or someplace and close, and you get on your knees and pray. I was afraid to do that. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to get up. So he might get a half-assed story because I didn't get down on my knees tonight. Like I said, we are not of one lot. And I have learned throughout my life that if I can make fun of something, preferably me, and laugh about something, then it's going to be okay. Because sometimes in my life it was either laugh or cry. And it's been the same through sobriety. I started drinking when I was like 14 years old. My mom worked for a school for girls, and she worked the night shift. So she'd buy us beer, and then she'd go to work and help those poor girls that were bad girls, and I'd be drinking with my friends all night. Luckily, I wasn't one of them. I had a blackout, and I didn't like the consequences of my drinking, so I quit. And I went through high school and things happened. Anyway, I was divorced at 20 the first time and started drinking in bars when I could at 21. And just, you know, I worked and I did all these things and I wasn't an alcoholic because I worked. And as long as I worked, I wasn't an alcoholic. And it was in the late 60s, early 70s, so, you know, there was all kinds of stuff around. And if somebody had it and offered it to me, I pretty much did it. But all through it all, I drank. I had 2 DUIs. The first one was in 1980. I'd spent a lot of time with a friend. I was living in Fresno at this time. Spent some time with a friend in Kingsburg, we were smoking that crazy tobacco and drinking beer all day, and I went home to Fresno. My daughter and I were in the car, and going about 30 miles an hour on the highway, and they got me just before I got to Ashland Avenue. I was almost home, and they stopped me, and I failed the ABC sobriety test, and I didn't know that for a long time. She must have asked me to take it backwards or something. I don't know. Because, you know, hell, I was so smart, I knew it. Anyway, I got put in jail overnight, and it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. I was devastated. That's the truth. In that cell and just crying, and it was the worst thing that ever happened. How could somebody like me that went to work every day end up in a place like this? And I got out and it was just, you know, that I was never going to smoke that stuff and drink beer again. I was going to continue drinking beer. I wasn't going to do that other stuff because I knew what the problem was. So about 8 years later, I was driving down the freeway after doing a little bit of that stuff like that, and drinking wine all day, and I was going about 80 miles an hour, and almost sideswiped to hire a patrolman. And at that time, when they put me in jail in 8 years, I'd gone from being devastated to being a mouthy, cussing out the people I could hear in the other parts of the jail, and they're cussing at me, and I'm cussing at them, and we're like, whatever. I can't remember what I said. I just know that I wasn't a very nice person. But that's what happened to me in 8 years. And I went to AA meetings. And I went to a place like Alternative Services. I don't know the name of it, but they had a little card, and I was supposed to go to meetings. And I went to one meeting, and I was drunk. And I talked about my brother, and because, whatever. Anyway, when I went to turn in my card that I didn't have filled out, there was something going on, and everybody was backed up, and there was some kind of something going on, I don't know. But I just turned around and walked out, and when they asked me, they said they didn't have my card. I said, well, I turned it in that night. And they couldn't prove that I didn't, and so I got away with it, you know, and I got my certificate of completing the course. You know, I got one over on them. And before that, in 1986, I went to AA meetings because my grandson had just been born. And I was sitting there on a weeknight knowing I had to get up and go to school and go to work. And I had this jug of wine, and I drank it until it was all gone. And I couldn't figure out why I drank it until it was all gone. I wanted to stop, you know. I needed to go to bed. And I just kept drinking it, and I called AA, and I don't know what possessed me to call AA, but I met this woman the next day at an AA meeting, and I went for 30 days, and I listened to the stories, and I said, you know what, I'm not that bad, because they did things that I hadn't, and they went up to bars and stuff. I drank at home. By then, I was drinking at home. I didn't like going home and looking, and then, you know, in the morning, when you go outside and you look to see if your car's there, and maybe if there's dents in it, or if there's blood on it. And I didn't like that. And so I started staying home because, you know. And then, of course, I get the urge to call. But anyway, I wasn't that bad, and so I quit going to meetings for another 4 years, or quit going to meetings and drank for another 4 years until I got that bad. You know, and what happened to me is I kept drinking, you know, and the last year, I can remember thinking, I don't want to drink today. And there'd be a wine glass with a little bit in it, and I'd pick it up and I'd drink it. And then it's on again. And I lived in Stockton, and I'd stop at this market in Tracy and get one of those things of vodka and some grapefruit juice and carry it around my car and get one of those 32-ouncer AMPM things that you can't tell what's in it. And I'd fill it full of ice and put soda in there in case anybody noticed. And then I'd go around the corner and I'd pour the soda out because, you know, everybody's paying attention to me, so I know they'd look and see what I was doing. And then I'd drive around all day and drink. It got pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And when I'm driving around and I can't find a bathroom, and so I just pee my pants. or, you know, heaven forbid that you have gas, because I don't know about you guys, but that's awful. I don't know if anybody else has experienced it, but I know I did. And when I got here, I was desperate. I was just totally desperate. I went to a treatment center in Stockton because I was still employed, and it was a 28-day center, treatment center, and I got out and started going to meetings, and I was filled with fear. You know, I did fine in that little, in that place where there's all these counselors and these people that you get to know. And when I got out and went to meetings, I'd sit there, and I was going to meetings quite a bit, and if somebody called on me, because I, heaven forbid, that I'd, you know, raise my hand to talk, if I got called on, I'd say, "My name's Susan, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober today, and I'm dying lousy inside." And at 60 days, I stopped and got some wine cooler and went to see this guy I was seeing, and it was on. And I took about 2 weeks, and my employer called and wanted to meet me in Lodi. And so I was only about an hour late, and I was drunk. I don't remember getting there. I drove from Hayward to Stockton, and I do not remember the drive, and or to Lodi, actually. And he had me follow him to Stockton to the treatment center because they were going to do a test on me. And they did, but they told him afterwards they can only test for drugs and not alcohol. But he could tell I was drunk. I mean, and I, you know, so they fired me. And I thought, why didn't they give me a break? They could have given me another chance, even though I signed this paper that said if I ever showed up drunk again, that I'd automatically be terminated. But, and I went on for another 2 weeks, and I never want to relive those 2 weeks again. The last night of my drinking, I was sitting in the parking lot at Kmart with a bottle of vodka in the trunk of the car, and wondering how I was going to kill myself, because I could no longer live the way I was living, and I just didn't know how to live without drinking. But I called that treatment center, and I went down and talked to them, and they asked me if I was willing to do anything, and I said, yeah. You know, they said, are you willing to go to a halfway house? And at that time, I was. If they'd asked me that when I got out of there, I would have said no, because, you see, I still got my apartment. I got a car. What about all my furniture? I got all this stuff. And at that time, I still had that stuff, but I said, yes, I'll do anything. And so they had me call these places to see if I could get in. And they wanted somebody, you had to have 30 days sobriety because it was tailored to be set up for people who just got out of treatment. Since I had like 2 days of sobriety, it didn't work. I think the main thing was that I was willing to do whatever it took to stay sober. And I started going to meetings, and I started talking about what was going on and telling you about all the fear I felt, and how I felt inadequate, and I felt like Ponstone. And if you knew who I really was, you'd all get up and walk out of here. I mean, that was the story of my life. I was nothing. And, you know, I'm not that today. I don't feel like that today. And it's all because of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the staff, and the women and the men in these rooms. I never thought that I would be sober. When I celebrated a year, I couldn't believe it. I stood up, and because it was at the front of a thing, and everybody's sitting there, and I stood up, you know, it's a year, and you say your name, and you're supposed to share a little bit, and I started crying, and then, of course, because it embarrassed me that I was crying, I started laughing, and because I was supposed to say a few things, I started talking. So I was snot running out of my nose, and I'm laughing, and I'm talking, and my sponsor's in the back, and she says, "Breathe, Susan, breathe," because I was talking so fast. You know, I got to get all this stuff out of here, because if I get it out really quick, maybe you won't hear it all, and maybe you won't think I'm horrible. And I used to wonder why I got lightheaded when I shared a meeting. It's because I wasn't breathing. I was talking. Oh, my gosh. You know, my first sponsor told me that my story starts when I get sober. Before that, you know, that's just the crap that happened, the crap that I put myself through and other people through. I raised my daughter in alcoholism, and it took me a long time to forgive myself for that. I grew up in an alcoholic family. Both my parents are alcoholics. The only way I knew to get out of alcoholism was to die. And now, at 60 years old, I've outlived both my parents. My dad died when I was 13 years old. He committed suicide. He was an alcoholic, and we all hated him. I was the youngest of four kids. None of us could stand him. He was buried in Ventura. And I was, that was in, what, 62. In 92, when I was 2 years sober, I went to the cemetery. And he did not have a marker on his grave, but I had looked into maybe getting a marker, so I had where the grave was. And it was on a day that the cemetery was supposed to be closed, and the gate was open. And I went in, and I found his grave, and I told him that I loved him, and that I forgave him, and that I knew exactly what he went through. And I was sorry. You know, I can't imagine what it was like for him to be hated by his family and not know why or what he can do about it, you know. I didn't want to do the things I did to my daughter. I wanted to be loving and kind and all that kind of stuff, and I wasn't. You know, I chose other people in front of her, and I just, I made a lot of mistakes. And what I realized then, my dad made a lot of mistakes. And, you know, we all do. And if I can't forgive him, how can I ever have a chance of forgiving myself? It wasn't until, I think, 2000, I think it was 2000, that my brothers and my sister and I all got together and we put a marker on his grave. My mom had died in 1979, and her ashes were scattered and out to sea. And she also committed suicide, so it's a family tradition. I've broken the tradition, thankfully. But her name's on the marker, too. And, you know, I was able to forgive her because I hated my mom. I hated her for abandoning me when I was a teenager. You know, she just split one day, and we didn't know what happened to her. And it wasn't until a year or so later that she came back. And I don't want to have anything to do with her. Last time I saw her, I said, you know, she wanted to come see the house. And I said, sure, when hell freezes over. I was joking. You know, it's all a joke, right? And I never saw her again. So that resentment I carried for 7 years after I got sober. And I finally realized that the only person I was hurting is me. You know, she's dead. She's not feeling that resentment. And I forgave her. And I got through that. But I just, you know, life is just, life is life. And we all make mistakes. And with drugs and alcohol, maybe we make a few more than others. We make choices that hurt other people. And I used to say, I'm only hurting myself. You know, I'm not bothering you. I know when, in 1988, my daughter moved out of the house and with her baby and her, maybe they, well, whenever anyway, her soon-to-be husband. And I lost all reason to maintain. And from then on, from 88 to 90, when I got sober, it was like it was on. And I didn't care about me. I didn't care about anything except for my grandson. But, you know, if I cared so damn much about him, I took him places. I took him all the time. He was always with me. And I was always drinking. There was never a time that I didn't have a drink with me. It's just, you know, I think about it now and I think, my God, how lucky. I am so fortunate that I didn't kill somebody. Because I drove more drunk than I drove sober. I used to, when they changed the law to .08, I used to say, I said, you know, I maintained that if they would have arrested me for being the .08, there would have been a daily day. I'd been on my way to work, you know. You know, the big book talks about how we speak of tragic things, but life is not glum. Life can be wonderful. All we have to do is stay sober. My first sponsor said, if you can't remember your sobriety date, maybe you don't have one. And she said, you know, you go to meetings so that you can remember what your last drunk was like. And if I ever forget my last drunk, I might repeat it. And I don't ever want to do that. I heard a speaker one time say, I wish you desperation. Because I tell you what, I had to be desperate in order to do the things that was required of me to stay sober. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is not for sissies. You know, it's not an easy, it's a simple program, but it hasn't been easy for me because I haven't wanted to tell you, for one thing, who I am. I haven't wanted to feel the things. I didn't want to grieve over my dad 30 years after he died. I don't want to grieve over all these other things that happened. I don't want to tell you that I'd gone off along the side of the road and took a crap because I had the runs. You know, that was one of those things that I was never, ever going to tell anybody. I'm here in front of all these people telling me. That must have been somebody else that happened to you because, you know, it wouldn't be me. Life is so good today that it is unbelievable. And it's not because I have a lot of money or a lot of possessions. It's because I feel good. I feel good inside. And you know, I've had bouts of depression, and actually I wanted to kill myself in sobriety. I was 2 years sober and I was depressed. My sponsor had said, do you think you're a little depressed? Nope, not me. You know, I don't want to be depressed. I'm an alcoholic. Isn't that bad enough? And I woke up one morning and I was crying and I couldn't stop crying. And so I waited until I got sober to be put in the mental hospital. But, you know, I am unique, you know. I was trying to figure out how I was going to end it. You know, we never had guns around the house, so that was out. And I couldn't take pills because I had to die sober. And so I thought, you know, well, the next thing would be to sit in a parked car, you know, and in a garage. Well, I had a carport, so, you know. Damn, I guess I just had to recover. I don't know. And start working the steps, and you know, it's just... And life has its ups and downs, and I have not wanted to feel those ups and downs. But I was desperate enough that I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to drink. And I think so long as you have that, you're going to make it. Because it's just, if you'll do anything in order not to drink or use, and you're probably going to stay sober. If you pick up the telephone and use that rather than get in the car and go get something, or rather than call your connection, if you call somebody on the AA list, you probably have a better chance of staying sober. I know it works for me. And one of the things, you know, the only thing I can tell you is my experience. And I have moved from, I got sober in Stockton. I moved from Stockton at about 2 years sober, moved to Santa Maria. I went to meetings there. First thing I did was find a meeting. And then the second thing I did was find the love of my life. You know, our eyes met across a crowded room. He had these beautiful blue eyes and a beard. I just fell in love with the beard. And this is my second relationship in sobriety. First one was after a little over a year sober. And this was at about almost 3.5 years. And I didn't really have a place to stay, so I moved in with him. You know, it must have been God's will, I'll tell you, because I go to town, I meet this guy, he asked me to live with him. You know, I always heard that God's will is when things go really smooth. So I figured it must be God's will. I didn't have a sponsor at the time in town, so I was taking my own advice, and I thought it was pretty darn good advice. About a year later, when he was yelling at me for something, for the very first time in my life, I said, yeah, I don't deserve to be talked to like that. And he said, well, but you. And I don't deserve to be talked to like that. And that was the end. But it was the beginning for me. I never before in my whole life thought that I didn't deserve to be talked to like that. I thought that if I was a drunk woman alcoholic, I deserved to be beat up, and I was. And I thought that being me, I deserved to be talked to however, any way, anybody wanted to. And pushed around and used, and all I was beat ass. That's what I was. That's how I felt most of my life. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much feeling the same thing. You know, I didn't change overnight. And we don't change overnight. We have to grow. And we have to change. And we got to work the steps. And we got to talk to the women and say, you know, is this really a good idea? What do you think about this one? This guy is
really good looking.
He's had many and out of 8 relationships in the last year, but I'm probably the one that could save him.
You know, the love of a good woman.
That was my battle cry. It didn't work. Maybe I wasn't a good woman. You know, the guys that I picked, the same guys in sobriety that I picked when I was drinking. And that was a real eye-opener. And I always thought the guys had picked me. You know, I mean, why do these jerks like me? And then I was told that I had something to do with the picking. But, you know, you look in the mirror and you say, you are the one responsible for your misery. Yeah, you're looking at the one responsible for your sobriety and for your choices. And I didn't want to hear that I was the one responsible for my choices, because that married man that I had a relationship with for 7 years, he was the one that was married, not me. So he was the one at fault, not me. You know? I mean, come on. Oh, my gosh. I don't do those kind of things today. The only married man I've slept with in 19 and a half years is my husband. And he's married to me. And I'm not going to go into that. That's another story for another time. No, life is good today. And I've learned about compromising, and I've learned how to have a relationship. I've learned how to be a friend. I've learned how to be a mother and a grandmother, and I was none of those things when I got here. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, has given me a life, and has helped me to become the person that I always wanted to be, but that was I never thought possible. You know, that minute at the start of the meeting seemed like about 15 minutes long. And I thought at the time, if that minute is that long, how the hell long is 40 minutes going to be? Well, I found out it's too long because I'm out of things to say. Thank you for letting me share.
Now for the audience participation portion of the meeting. We invite questions for our speakers when we run short. So if any of you have any questions, I understand that Susan would love to entertain them. So let me introduce Susan again. Let's bring her back up to the microphone here. And if you have any questions, please raise your hand as you're calling.
And now I'm here to entertain you. Yes, ma'am. How long have you been sober? Three months? 6 months?
16, 17.
Yeah. It takes longer than 16 days. You know, things just start getting clearer. I can remember thinking whenever something would happen, the first thing I'd think about was to take a drink. And it was like 9 months or so when I realized, wow, I didn't think about taking a drink this time. So it's just, it happens. It just stays sober. And you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And that's the promises. And those promises do come true. They are promises. They're not maybes. Always. They will always materialize. Yes. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry? When? It always is. There's no question. I'm still sober. I stayed sober through it. No matter what, sobriety is more important than anything. Because if I don't have sobriety, I have nothing. So I realized that I was more important. And I figured at that time I was willing to stay single the rest of my life if I had to, rather than put myself through that ever again. But it wasn't sobriety that wasn't important, it was me. And that was like at 3.5 years. Not everybody has to wait that long.
Why do you think that the tradition is important in the tradition?
Why are they important? Because we stay sober by the steps, and the groups stay sober by the traditions, the groups. And actually, we can live by the traditions too. The seventh tradition says we're fully self-supporting by our own contributions, and that's a good thing to be, not just as a group, as a person. And the traditions are important because they help us stay together. You know, they tell us that no one person is more important than the group, and that's true. You know, it doesn't matter who's here or who leaves, there's nobody in charge. You know, Bill, my thinking is, we ran just fine last week without him, didn't we?
Yeah.
He's sorry he asked me to get up here for questions. Did that answer your question?
No.
Okay. Next. You know, I remember talking one time in Bakersfield. I was at 10 minutes. And at the time I said, you know, I hear people come up here and they say, I love everyone. And I said, you know, I don't feel that way. I'm sorry, I don't love all of you because I don't know you. But then I changed my definition of love. And I think love is wanting the best for a person. It has nothing to do with you, it's all of us, and I do love everyone, because I want the best for all of you. I want you all to stay sober and to live a long, happy life, or at least a long, sober life, because nobody's life is going to be happy all the time. That's not reality. But reality is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous teaches us how to live in all conditions. And if you work the steps, when you read the first 164 pages of this big book about Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a sponsor, you use a sponsor, and you get a support group going, and you don't make somebody of the opposite sex your higher power, or somebody of the same sex if you're wired that way. It doesn't make any difference. Then your life is going to be okay, whether it's good, whether you're poor or rich, or you have tragedies or not. It's going to be okay. We can get through anything. We don't have to have something to dull our feelings and to kill us, because that's what it is. It's a long, slow death. It's kind of like Alzheimer's, huh? Because I'm in blackouts all the time, you know? From the time I started drinking, I was in blackouts. But I couldn't be an alcoholic, so I drank that a couple of times. And then I read in here that it's not how often you drink, or how long you drink, or what you drink. It's what happens to you when you drink. And when I drink, I wanted more. So when I drank, half the time I blacked out. And when I had one drink, I didn't know when it was going to stop. I could have a couple of beers after work. And then the next night, I'd have a beer, and I'd drink until it was all gone. And I'd want more. You know, there's nothing quite as bad as on my last weekend drinking. I went to this 24-hour market, and I bought a little six-pack or four-pack, whatever they are, those wine coolers. And they wouldn't sell them to me because it was 5 minutes till. And I was humiliated. You know, I've learned about humility in this program, which means I can't do it, but we can. I don't take credit for it. If I could stay sober without a higher power and without you guys, I wouldn't be here. But I couldn't stay sober on my own. And, you know, humiliation is going into a liquor store, trying to buy some booze, and they say it's too early. You know, I've never had it too early to buy water, and I've never seen them say it's too early to buy a soda. But I did experience it being too early to buy wine. They obviously didn't know who I was.
One more question. Would you tell us how you chose your sponsor, and what do you get from the sponsor?
She pays me. And I appreciate it. My first sponsor, how do you choose? You choose a sponsor because that's just who the sponsor is supposed to be. I mean, yeah, for me, I didn't look around, and it was like I was drawn to the person that was my sponsor. And unless, I guess, you experience it, you don't know what that means. But I was just drawn to, there's been three ladies that have been my sponsors. One in Stockton, one in Santa Maria, and one here. And Cheryl has paid me the most, but she's been sober all year. So it's just, you know, and two of the, actually all three of them, they've been women that people say, wow, you scared me when I first came in. And I never felt like that. They didn't scare me. She still doesn't. No, I just, you know, I think it's just something that happens. If one sponsor doesn't work for you, and she's not working the steps, or he's not working the steps with you, then you find another one. And it's like, you don't even have to have the same interests or anything. You just have to be willing to call them and work with them. And they have to be willing to work with you and work the steps. And if they're not willing to work the steps with you, then you find another sponsor. Thank you. I guess I did say something that he liked.
Did that answer your question?